When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Blockbuster Mentality, where we're doing something we've never done before on the show, which is talk Star Trek. That's right, Dave here. There's no Ben. Why? Because Ben has never watched an episode of Star Trek. He's never watched a Star Trek movie. And so
he must comply.
Yeah, he must. At some point, we will assimilate him. So, as you can hear, that voice in the background is returning guest Ryan L. Terry coming back. I think, Ryan, you were here for the Sunset Boulevard episode. Long time.
I was. Two episodes, Sunset Boulevard and then top Oscar-winning songs, I believe it was. And on that topic, of course, the song I picked for number one just celebrated its 40th anniversary last week, which was the iconic Flashdance, What a Feeling.
Yeah.
And so it's so I was on another podcast earlier this week celebrating the Cinema Speak podcast. And we were celebrating the 40th anniversary of Flashdance. So I was able to talk about it. But yeah, it's 40 years. And that's our tie-in, because that was an Oscar-winning song, and here we are. So it all works together.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time, but I remember it being a little bit kind of, the setup is a little silly. Doesn't she work at a steel?
Oh, the plot's terrible. You don't watch it for the plot's terrible.
Well, so no, I wasn't watching it for the plot. But yeah, fantastic. And of course, you can find Ryan at rlterryrealview.com to catch all his fantastic reviews at rlterry1 on Twitter. Or you can move down to Tampa and attend his film class at the University of Tampa, right?
Yes, I certainly can. And you can also hang out with me on Letterboxd, which I started. That was my New Year's resolution this year, was to finally bite the bullet, jump on the Letterboxd bandwagon. Even though I resisted, but as we've learned, resistance is futile. So I have become assimilated in the Letterboxd cult, and I resisted for a long time because I had about 500 reviews on my blog, and like, well, if I jump on Letterboxd now, it's going to look like I've not watched anything.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I guess I will just add films a little at a time. So I started with the most recent and worked my way backwards. And I'm up to 2014. So I think I only have about 10 or 12 more months of reviews to add. And then everything from my blog will finally be on Letterboxd. But yeah, it's letterboxd.com/RLTerry there on that platform.
Great. Yeah, I have an account. I think I've made two reviews. I just haven't gone back to it. And that's been one of my things too, is to actually try to be more active on there. So that's one of my goals as well. Well, Ryan, it is great to have you here, because
thanks.
For me, I get to have on a guest who not only knows more about film than I do, but I know you know more about Trek than I do. So I know you're always tweeting about Trek, talking about Trek. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with Trek, why you fell in love with it.
Yeah, Star Trek, I grew up with it. I can tell you some of my fondest memories growing up are Friday nights with a frozen pizza, because my earliest years, my dad was still in graduate school. So, it wasn't a lot of extra money. So the treat was getting pizza, sitting down on, I don't remember if it was Thursday or Friday nights, but sitting down as a family to watch Star Trek: The Next Generation. And that was a routine from 87 all the way up until 94. And then in 95 with Voyager. Although I was a little more into Voyager than my parents, we still would sit down and watch Voyager. on the, was it a UPN? Because it was their big show that they launched with.
Yeah.
I watched watch that. Deep Space Nine, though, we didn't watch together because it is a bit more of a mature show. So my parents always told me that I was too young to watch DS9. And as an adult looking back, I can see, yeah, it's a different kind of Trek and is a more mature version. It deviates from the formula a little bit. And it's not one that I tend to rewatch as often, although I am presently going back through it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that was just suffice it to say, a weekly routine all through my childhood. And it continues to teach us today. I watch a episode after episode. I've seen every episode of TNG and Voyager, I don't know how many dozen times. Uh-huh. And it never gets old. It's often on in the background. And not only me, my best friend and her husband, who's also a very good friend of mine, it's on in the background at their house too. So whenever we get together, it's usually TNG or Voyager or DS9 in the background. And so we may be shooting the breeze about something completely unrelated. I like how the lightning got slaughtered the other night. And so it was, but it's still there. And we all agree that it is such a forward-thinking show because so much of the exploration of the human condition can be related to today. It's still relevant. And without going down, I guess, more of a critical analysis of Trek, just summarize it to say, because Trek had stories that could only take place in the Star Trek universe. And that was a big thing for the writers. Jerry Taylor and Rick Berman, they were very big on, that's a great story, but it's not Star Trek. Mm-hmm. The stories here could only take place in Star Trek. And because of that, they're not about anything specific to either the 20th or now 21st century America or world. However, the subject matter, the subtext of the plots and the subject matter is really about stuff that was happening then, and you can relate it to today. Probably an easy example, but one of the best episodes of Trek is Command Structure, I think is the name of the episode, but it's the one very famous for There Are Four Lights. Mm-hmm. And that's all about gaslighting. And yeah, you can apply gaslighting and resilience in a variety of ways. And we call it brainwashing, but I know that's a bit of an antiquated, oversimplification. But you can apply that to today, and you can see how important the lessons that Star Trek teaches us are still should be revered today. I feel if more people watch Next Generation, for the most part, Voyager was a little more adventurous, a little less heavy on the human condition, but it was still there. Especially when Seven comes on board. Prior to Seven, it was still finding its way. Seven comes on board. Voyager really comes into its own. And so we have these lessons, which are just so rich. And I love how they never get old. Yeah. And there's topics that they touch on indirectly that are like, wow, they were talking about that then. That's something that maybe we're only doing today, or isn't being done today. And it's just like, well, I wish people today could watch that, because, well, then maybe they would change their minds about X, Y, Z, or give them pause to think. And that's why I love Star Trek, in particular, Captain Picard, definitive Starfleet captain, and Seven of Nine are, if I had to pick just two favorite Star Trek characters, it would be Captain Picard and Seven of Nine. And so I'm so glad that they feature heavily into Star Trek Picard, because it's not just me. I think those are two characters that people often remark are their favorites from the Star Trek universe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think brilliantly said, particularly about your point of it's allegorical, but it never bangs the hammer over your head. It raises these issues. Mm-hmm. It gets you to think, but doesn't,
yes,
it doesn't tell you what to think. And the stories present themselves oftentimes there's no real clear answer that, you know, mm-hmm. you have these moral dilemmas. So you, yes. you approach these human problems sort of, you're out there in space, you know, in the 23rd, 24th century, wherever we are. And it gives you a place to explore sort of social philosophy questions. And then you can take that back and think, oh, okay, this is how I can think about this problem in my mm-hmm. own, in my own life. And I think that when Trek is doing that well, that's when it's at its best. And when it deviates from that is when it kind of sucks.
and it does. It's a formula. And I love I love what you said. It's allegory. And that's really what it is. It's an extended metaphor. It's allegory. And when it ceases to be that, it ceases to be Star Trek. You know, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit later in talking about, you know, Picard season 3, but there is a formula mm-hmm. and the formula works when you deviate from the formula, regardless of what the general public, what you think the general public is saying or what the general public is saying. If you deviate from the formula, it doesn't work. If you want to create a futuristic adventure about you fill in the blank, but it's not following the Star Trek formula, create it. Please do. You know, create original content. We need more original shows. However, don't call it Star Trek. Call it something else. Like Discovery, and I'll just get this out the front right away. Discovery is not Star Trek. It's just not.
No, it's not.
Don't call it Star Trek. I'm not knocking the show. You know, per se, it's not a good show.
No, it's not.
And we call it Star Trek. And then I just read this morning that I thought it was canceled and they've started filming again. It's like, oh my gosh, have you not been paying attention to all the conversations that are around Lower Decks, Star Trek Picard, and Strange New Worlds? Nobody wants Star Trek Discovery. Yes, Michelle Yeoh, phenomenal actress. I'm not knocking the performances at all. And I love when I see they command screen presence like Michelle Yeoh, you know, in a TV series. It has nothing to do with that. It has everything to do with the characters, the plots, the themes. It's not Star Trek. You can call it Star Trek. You can put them on a starship. It's not Star Trek. It's just not a good show. Yeah. And it's like, are you not paying attention? Why is Paramount Plus only still surviving because of Star Trek? It's not because of Discovery. It is because of, well, now Picard, but I wouldn't have said that a year or two ago. It's surviving because of Lower Decks, and it is surviving because of now Strange New Worlds and Voyager, TNG, DS9, the ability to rewatch those. And I say the old school Nickelodeon also plays into the Paramount Plus success formula right now. But that's what it is. So I hope what we take from the success of especially the latter part of season 3 of Picard is that the public likes the Star Trek formula. I don't care that there's this mindset in the world by so many that institutions are corrupt. You know, the past, you know, is holding us back from moving forward. And we must take down, you know, legacy this and history that. And it's like the history was written by so-and-so and expressed in such and such a way. It's just, I hope what we learn is like, no, you don't just simply, you know, throw everything out that you think you don't like. Some of this stuff, it really works. And it is something that we can learn from. And it's like, no, perhaps the past had it right, even though there's this idea that somehow the past is corrupt.
Yeah.
It's like, no. And so there's Star Trek inspires, you know, these kinds of conversations.
Yeah.
And I'm glad it's happening again.
Absolutely. I mean, just to your point, I mean, the first season of Picard started, it was a deconstruction of the character. And it's like, what in God's name am I watching? And the audience responded so positively to this change in season three. I believe for the first time ever, you probably saw this. Well, it's trends on Twitter all the time these last 10 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I believe, and in the Nielsen streaming, I think is the very first time a show, a streaming Star Trek show cracked the top 10 was this season of Picard. And
wow.
So,
awesome.
Yeah. It's here, guys. But the thing is, here's the thing. They know it. And I think they consciously, I don't think they like us, Ryan, as their audience. They want a different audience. I don't think they want us. I don't know why they want to change it. They're going to take this beloved IP and turn it into their own thing until, as you say, not Star Trek. For some reason, and I can't even imagine this is even making them money. I don't get it. It's not popular. I don't know how you look at Rotten Tomatoes and you see 90%+ on these seasons. I don't know if they're paying off these reviewers or what. Yeah,
because everybody I know is like, season one is watchable. I didn't hate season one. Well, I didn't like it in the beginning. By the time we get to the end of season one, I like it well enough. Season one is watchable. Season two is complete garbage. Other than getting to see Whoopi Goldberg as Guinan, not young Guinan. Young Guinan needs to go away.
Yeah.
But
at her bar 10 forward.
Yes. And then Q. And yeah. Other than getting to see John DeLancey reprise the indelible enigmatic Q in season two and getting to see Whoopi Goldberg reprise the role of Guinan, there's nothing else. And the Borg Queen too, but there's nothing else about the plot and about the characters. It was, again, it's this revisionist history that we see everywhere. And it's a deconstruction of the present and the past and in a very applied postmodernistic way. And it's not healthy. And yet we're injecting this into something that it shouldn't be. Yeah. It's like, you know, if you want to do that, fine. Don't call it Star Trek.
Yeah.
Because this show did not start resonating with, fans, young and old, whether they grew up with Star Trek on first run or they watched it in syndication or on streaming. It didn't resonate until this third season. And then increasingly so with the last few episodes. And those are your most dedicated and vocal fans. Are the ones that have been there the whole time. They are the ones who will subscribe to Paramount Plus because they want to watch this.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's like I like Paramount Plus well enough, but there's what I feel is keeping it alive is the Star Trek connection.
Yeah.
And this gets back to what makes Star Trek Star Trek. It has a formula. It's not a bad formula. Formulas are a good thing. Remember in math class, formulas are a good thing. Formulas work for a reason. You know, they've been proven over and over and over. So don't deviate from it because you have an unequal equation and then we spend, our time trying to, how to make it equal on both sides. I'm right there with you.
Yeah, I'll quickly tell my my introduction to Trek story. I think you'll appreciate this. My introduction to Star Trek was my best friend at the time. I forget how old I was. I was just a kid. Took me to a Star Trek convention, and I didn't know what Trek was. I didn't even know what I was walking into, and I walked out of there with a signed photo from Walter Koenig. And I didn't even know who the guy was.
That's cool.
And I just see all these people dressed up in their Starfleet uniforms. And I was like, wow, what is this? And then I got into TNG, watched that a million times. And then, of course, the original series. Those are really my two, my go-tos. I'm not as big of a Voyager and DS9 fan. And in fact, the transfer or the HD or 4K transfers for TNG, those hold up well.
Yes.
Voyager and DS9, they don't really look good anymore when you stream.
Well, do you know why? Because in TNG, we were using models. There was some CG, but it was mostly for phasers and lasers. I mean, that kind of stuff. But in terms of the ships and the sets, it's all practical. And thankfully, we have a very tactile, practical
bridge of the Enterprise D in season 3 of Picard, and the Ready Room, the podcast YouTube show, you know, by Will Wheaton, you know, took us on a tour, and and getting to meet with the original designer who designed this, and like they were like, no, this is, we are literally recreating, you know, down to, you know, every last detail, the ship, and you can tell in the show it looks real and it's not hidden behind a bunch of dark light. I don't know why we insist on making all these shows the lighting so incredibly dark. And so, but we're not hiding anything. But in Voyager, you, because there was never a Voyager model, to the best of my understanding. I've never once heard of a scale model that was used in the way the Enterprise D was. And so everything is CG, but it's 1997, 1998 CG, which looked fine enough on a 27 or 32 inch TV back then. It doesn't look good anymore. So when you're with the characters, it looks fine. But anything in space is just like, this, it looks kind of a little sus. So yeah, but that's why it still, you know, holds up so well, because it was shot 35 millimeter cameras. We use real models. And so no matter how big you blow up that model, it still looks really good, because you've got a lot of real detail in it. And when the light hits it, it's hitting a real object. We're not simulating light and simulating shadow. That's real light and that's real shadow.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And in fact, the 4:3 aspect ratio doesn't bother me at all. And it, sometimes I kind of prefer it, because you get to see, you lose in 16:9, you lose the height of the scene, and you can you can see generally almost, you know, entire person above their head to below their feet, which you just don't get a lot. So yeah, it's not, it's kind of interesting to revisit that. All right, so let's start with season 3. We basically get, I don't know the opening scene. I think it's Picard with his mistress, I think, and then we cut to Beverly, who's out there being what do we want to call her, like Doctors Without Borders kind of mission.
That's a good equivalent.
Yeah, and then she's basically under attack. We don't really know what's going on, and then we later find out it's Jack. What'd you think of this, Ryan? This opening, as we kind of, as the reveal of who Jack is, and of course we get Picard and who meets Riker, and then they're kind of connecting. What are you, your initial kind of thoughts at this kickoff to the story?
Oh, my initial thought was, this is Wrath of Khan, which isn't a bad thing. Most would say that Wrath of Khan is the best Star Trek film. Yeah. And as much of a TNG fan as I am, I say Wrath of Khan is the best Star Trek. First Contact, second best, but Wrath of Khan, definitely best. So who cares if you're emulating that? I saw a lot of people hate on that. Like, why are we watching Wrath of Khan? Well, why not? It hasn't been done since Wrath of Khan. So that's like over 40 years ago. And so why not bring that back? Chances are there's a lot of people out there who are just now getting introduced to Star Trek Picard that haven't seen Wrath of Khan. They should now.
Yeah.
Because it is the best Star Trek film. Mm-hmm. But it is. I wasn't sure where we were going with it. But like, I picked up on that. I'm like, okay, Wrath of Khan. So it's like, so we're connecting it to something well established in the past, and I was okay with it. I wasn't quite sure what to make of it, but I was okay with it. It's like, maybe it offered a little hope. It's like, maybe we are getting back to Star Trek's roots, because I think exploring Picard's relationship with others, relationship with family, although the family thing doesn't actually, it kind of doesn't work, because we learn a lot about his family in season 4, episode 2, which I think is actually called The Family, when he goes back to his home and his brother is like, well, he actually seems like he has an okay relationship with his brother. So, and he never really talked bad about his parents, and all of a sudden we're talking bad about parents. But I think that was just a pander to these Gen Zers who are just prone to think that, you know, any authority figure has, you know, has it out for you. And so that's why we can't have Picard come from a, not that it does, I mean, from a mostly healthy family, because we learn in the series that he never really complained about his family. All of a sudden we are, but that's a whole other story. But I like that we're exploring that aspect, because he has always kept a wall there.
Yes.
And that was consistent from through TNG, through Picard, even in season 1 and 2, there is a wall there. So that has been consistent. So I think it's very fair to explore that. And we should, because on the Enterprise, they were a family. And I love the line from, I think it's season 5, in which the young boy loses his parents, and Picard responds to him, "On the Starship Enterprise, no one is alone. No one." Love that line, because they were a family, but he was always just on the outside of it. And that's hinted at in the series finale, the TNG series finale, and which is a 5-car stud, nothing wild, sky's the limit. And, you know, just before that, he's Deanna says, "You were always welcome," referring to the poker game.
Yeah.
And so we begin to see that there, that wall come down just a little bit. So I liked the setup.
Yeah. Brilliant there. And of course, Picard almost hilariously hated kids. Mm-hmm. TNG, but
the gif, I'm a role model, that gif comes up, you know, ever so often on Captain Picard Day. And I love that. Yeah. And that's one of my favorite episodes is the where he has to work with the kids. Yeah. And they're climbing up the Jeffrey's tube singing Frere Jacques. And like, that's really good, because it was so outside of his comfort zone. Like, he was so, and we hardly ever see Captain Picard uncomfortable or vulnerable.
Yeah.
And we do. And it's any time you talk about kids or even, you know, family, you know, to an extent, kids much to a greater extent. So like, I like this, because it's going to force him to go where he's never gone before.
Yeah. And to confront, his own issues and stuff that he's been kind of maybe put aside for his job for basically decades. And here he is sort of at the end of his life. And yes, he saved saved the galaxy many times. Mm-hmm. But personally, he kind of suffered a bit. He never really had the relationships that that he wanted. Now he's looking back. And then that tie-in of forever he said, I don't want kids. I'm here for Starfleet. I'm focused on my job. But here is this man now who is my son. And how do I deal with that? But then also it kind of became in its own way a blessing, I think, for him to kind of complete that journey of his life. And because at the end, he kind of regretted it, right? That he didn't, he never had those relationships. And what we'll call, you know, kind of a legacy. There's a hint maybe to a possible new Star Trek series. We'll see.
Yeah. That legacy hashtag. It's like, have I missed something? Because I don't recall hearing an official announcement, but hashtag Star Trek Legacy.
Yeah. It's which completely fan driven.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I know, because we say legacy, Rafi says your legacy, referring to 7 of 9 at the end when she's about to give her first command line. And I love that we don't know what it is. And then because Rafi says this is your legacy. So because anytime I've seen hashtag Star Trek Legacy, it's generally associated with 7 of 9. So I don't know, you know, what that is. But so, yeah. So also it's kind of like a hashtag release the Snyder Cut. Yes. Kind of. OK.
Yes. Yeah, that's basically exactly what it is. Well, it's even less so because at least there was somewhat of a movie to cut into a Snyder Cut. There is no show legacy. And I hope we get it. We'll see. But just moving on here. Yeah, we get to the Titan, speaking of 7 of 9, where we see her, and we're introduced to Captain Shaw, played by Todd Stashwick, who, oh man, just totally knocks this thing out of the park.
Oh, he's great. Yeah. He's so good. I was like, I like this guy. Yeah. He was very, like, I mean, there were things I didn't like about him, but it's like, I like the things that I didn't like about him. He was just delivering his lines so incredibly well, just completely balls to the wall Starfleet captain.
Yeah.
And just very, very rigid, and kind of reminded me of Captain Jellicoe from the Chain of Command episode.
Yeah.
And so now Jellicoe, much more of an asshole than Shaw, but he does have, he was kind of channeling that. So it's like, I don't think I like you, but I like you. And yeah. So, and he, just the chemistry between he and, of course, for him, Commander Hansen, is incredibly good.
Yeah, that that tension there between them, and of course, Shaw is entirely correct in his disposition, because Picard and Riker come over basically to take over his ship, literally, to go to save Beverly, and then we find out later that when Picard was Locutus, one of the reasons why he resents Picard and why he's so gruff in the beginning, I think they were going to eat, they were going to have dinner, and Shaw basically just finished his meal and said, get the hell out of here, is that he was attacked by the Borg.
Because I think he was at Wolf 359, if I remember correctly.
I think that's right, yeah. And so it all makes sense. He's basically thrown into the plot, literally, and under peril for, you know, through no control of his own. He wants really nothing to do with this, get the hell out of here kind of a thing. And so I think that's why we sympathize with him. And then his sort of humorous kind of fatalistic delivery of his lines, you know, he's like, he's always like, oh great, you know, kind of a thing.
Here we go. There's a dark humor to his character that I really appreciate.
Yeah, absolutely. And then this is where we, you know, we're not going scene by scene here, but this is where we get introduced to Vadik, played by Amanda Plummer, piloting the Shrike.
Amanda Plummer, a ship, who. You know who her very famous late father is?
Christopher Plummer.
Christopher Plummer. So I thought it's a great little Hollywood legacy here in Star Trek.
And she was in Pulp Fiction, I believe, right?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, I think with the drug dealing boyfriend. Yeah. I think that was her. Yeah, she's so good. I mean, she's she's over the top, but it doesn't bother me. I think it's played so well. She's maniacal, and it comes off great. What do you think of her performance?
Oh, excellent performance. I very much see how she's channeling her father in the performance, and just having learned from, you know, one of the best actors that you know, Hollywood past or present had ever, you know, seen on the screen, and just you're really scared of her because of just how you know, just terrifying her thought process is. And she's not just out for revenge, she's out, you know, it's a sadistic form of revenge, and that's what makes her, you know, terrifying. And we learn, although you don't need to have seen DS9 to know, or Star Trek Nemesis to, you know, know more about the Dominion and then a bit of the relationship between you know, Picard and Data. I think having, you know, if you watch DS9 or if you watch Nemesis, you do have a greater appreciation for some of the context in Picard, especially here in the Picard Data beginning of season one, and then with DS9, some of what is going on here with the Dominion, because that's, you know, one of the big bads, or like the big bad, I guess, if you will, from DS9.
Yeah, because I don't think the Changeling plot line or any of that was introduced to TNG at all. And I think in the original series, there was one episode where there was a Changeling. I don't know if it's exactly the same, but yeah, that's really all you'll see it unless you're familiar with DS9. And then we do learn about they gave them it was like a tainted virus that killed a whole bunch of them, right? Is that, did I have that right?
Yeah.
And so revenge for that. And this is, she's hunting Jack. There's a bounty on Jack's head. And there's this real, I mean, what I love about this is there's a real conflict of, what do we do with Jack? Everything is like happening so fast. Picard learns this is his son. Here's Vadik. And with a ship that has this portal weapon and like basically every weapon imaginable.
It sucks up that recruiting center for Starfleet. And it was like playing a game of Portal. And so I'm sure is where that came from, but it's great. And so it just like sucked up the whole thing. It's just like, oh my gosh, this is going to be bad.
This is serious. So what do we do? Shaw's like, Shaw's ready to hand over Jack until Picard says, no, he's my son. And then it changes. But what I love, every character, the conflict is completely character driven based on their own internal motivation. So you have Vadik, you have Shaw, you have Seven, you have, and here's Riker. And then there's Beverly. They all have everything is derived from their own motivations. It's driving the plot
character
forward.
Driven, which is what Star Trek in its purest form, the Star Trek formula is one that is character driven. And that's one thing that separates it from Star Wars. And although I like Star Trek more than Star Wars, I'm not knocking Star Wars. It's just a different kind of storytelling. They're not supposed to be the same. And when you're taking like when J.J. Abrams tries to make Star Trek like Star Wars, it doesn't work. They're two different expressions of a futuristic idea. One is a space opera, space western, and the other really is more of a straight drama, but it has exciting elements. It has the futuristic style, but it is, you know, one's a drama, the other is it's action adventure, and that's fine.
Yeah.
And in season three, we get more of that. We get more of the character driven conflict. And so we're leaning more into that formula, because the plot of season three is, you know, stop Vadic, you know, ultimately, you know, stop, you know, the Borg Queen. It's very simple plot. And but we have incredibly complex characters.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And I love this cat and mouse game that's going on inside the nebula. The Titan is losing power, and sort of, I guess what I would call the conclusion of the first act of the season is this. How would you describe this? This birth of a what is this thing? But it's crazy. There's something going on in this nebula. Yes. Something is being born or reborn. I don't know which. And then the Titan is basically able to ride the wave of these impulses to power the ship out. And it's fantastic, and it has a really deeply moving effect on Riker. Because he's been mourning the death of his son, really disconnected from Deanna. He's just kind of super depressed. The relationship is kind of non-existent, and this really kind of brings back his faith in the universe.
Like, he's looking for being grounded. Everything that he has in the present is being, you know, ripped out from underneath of him, and he's looking to the past in order to find himself again. And so he is, you know, looking for his footing. And that's why, you know, Picard is so very important to him, because Picard represents the best that Riker was, regardless of what season one and two told us, where Picard somehow had this negative impact on everybody around him. Complete garbage.
So stupid.
Total character assassination. Again, it gets back to the whole, well, we can't, you know, authority is bad. Authority must be overthrown. You know, authority is out to oppress you. And so, like, I get it. You're leaning into, I'll just go ahead and say it, you're leaning into the woke mob. And it's like, that is not, That's not Star Trek, you know. There, you know, he's revered for his loyalty, and revered for order, and revered for his moral and ethical center. That's why Q was fascinated with Picard. It was his moral and ethical center, and his character should not have been disparaged in how it was in seasons one and two, because Riker's looking for that here in season three. He's like, you know, Picard is able to, you know, ground me. And Picard represents the best of humanity. It's not perfect, because humanity is flawed. Picard's flawed. All these characters are flawed. But despite the flaw, still represents the best that we can be. Well, all of it collectively, because they each represent a different facet of humanity. You know, our magnificent seven, so to speak.
And so
collectively they represent the best that we can be, flaws and all. And that's what, you know, really, you know, gets to Riker, because at the beginning of three, it's like hashtag not my Riker, which isn't mine. It's Stork from Besotted Geek podcast, TNG Star Trek podcast for listeners. If you're looking for something more Star Trek specific,
it's a good show.
He's like hashtag not my Riker. And I get it. But he becomes Riker, but he is lost. So he's not Riker. Because Riker would never admit defeat. Riker would never be weak. But that's where he was.
Yeah.
And it took this, being this conflict to bring him around again. And he and Picard very much defeated after, you know, Picard says, you know, yeah, we need to fire now, fire now, fire now. And then the portal weapon comes out and everything they fired at the strike just came back and nearly destroyed the Titan. And it was just like, oh boy. It's like, he's going to the brig. He is court-martial for sure after this. And it was just really sad because it, you know, he was so convinced that that was the course of action, and it came back around to literally bite them in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was very low, you know, period. In his life and in the show.
Yeah. It looked like a total no-win scenario. And you know, there's a difference between character maintaining the core of who they are, but also showing them where they are now. I mean, they're all in their 70s, basically.
Yeah.
and you're right. He wasn't the Riker we last saw, mm-mm, necessarily, or the one we completely remember from TNG, but he had gone through something and he needed to find his way back. And I don't think I've ever seen Jonathan Frakes better in his career.
Oh, it was great. It's so very, so good. I mean, all of them were just, you're just channeling, you know, your character, but you're even more convincing than you are, especially Worf. Every line of Worf's is a complete banger. Every single one of them. Like, he was like that is who Worf would be 35 years later, or see, Nemesis was 2003 or 4, I think. So however many years it's been.
Yeah.
Like, that is, he is, and I love the bait and switch, because in the trailers, which I try to avoid as much as possible, but sometimes you can't avoid a trailer and it just accosts you when you're like watching something else. And
and
I was worried because we get that clip in the trailer. It was like, because Rafi says something about him being a warrior, and then he said, I'm a pacifist. And I'm like, oh my gosh, are we really going here? Because after seasons 1 and 2, fully convinced that they would turn Worf into a pacifist. But I like that it was a bait and switch where it's just like, no, he's still an honorable warrior.
Oh, yes. And, he will not hesitate to decapitate someone.
No.
He's just trying to find some sort of inner peace. That's really all it is. Uh-huh. And you know, Michael Dorn is eating up every second, loving every line, and just he's great. He was so good. All right, great. So we could spend like hours on this. Let's kind of move on to the middle episodes, episodes 5 through 8, which I think is kind of really what I call a second act. To me, this is where the show kind of bogs down for me. There's not really a ton happening. And the main thing is Jack, finding out more about Jack and I guess the Red Door. What do you think of newer Trek kind of introducing, I don't know, because you're the horror guy, and I guess I would call this kind of a horror element. He's getting
Definitely some horror adjacency especially in the middle.
Yeah.
And I like it because it's very creepy.
Yeah. And one thing I liked a lot is Jack is seeing these visions. He's got the red eyes, and then I guess we start to see some sort of a version of, I don't know if you'd call it telepathy or body taking over someone's body in a sense, kind of.
Yes. It's like housing, like
mind control.
Where you can like overtake I can't think of the right word, but enter their mind.
Yeah.
And kind of almost like Bran in Game of Thrones, where he can inhabit. That's the word I was looking for, inhabit.
Yeah.
And so it's because Bran, you know, could inhabit the direwolf or inhabit the raven. And so we kind of have that same idea in here, where he can inhabit the mind, and the indicator is the red eyes, but it's still very unclear as to, I don't think this is a good thing. I don't know what's going on here or what this is leading to, but it was very much intriguing because you started thinking, the rest of the time we're kind of in Jack's corner, but you know, perhaps he's actually a villain here.
Yes.
And so that's what I started thinking. Maybe I didn't think he was cognizant that he was a villain, maybe more of a sleeper, which I guess is kind of what happens. But like, it's like, there is something. There's something very there's something not right.
Yeah, certainly. And it's is Jack. Is he a changeling? He doesn't know. Mm-hmm. And one thing I love, I think this was a perfect move or a great move by the writing staff, was to not have Jack keep this inside of him. You see lesser shows do this kind of a thing. He's very forthright with going to Beverly and saying,
"Yeah,
there's something wrong with it." And so it wasn't one of those things where it's, you know, it's all just in his head. He's having these visions. He's keeping it to himself. And then it blows up into something. And I like the choice to do right away. He's reaching out and then it helps sort of the problem solving of what is actually going on with him. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I know. Very much so. He's like, I don't know what's wrong with me. There's something wrong with me. It's been here for, you know, for a long time. And it's like, you know, this is when it gets really scary, especially for Beverly. She's like, how could I have not have seen this, and beginning to you know, doubt her skills as a mother, which is, I'm sure, very, very disturbing, very disheartening. And so she has so many battles going on at the same time.
Yeah.
But she responds to it. She responds to them in maybe not how Gates McFadden would respond to them, or how the individual writers, or I guess the series finale was Terry Metalis, was both the writer and director. But she responds how Dr. Crusher would respond.
Yeah.
And I noticed that about all of these characters here in the third season, is they're not responding how the writers want them to respond. They're not responding how the individual actors would respond. They are responding how their character, their 35-year-old character, would respond to this situation.
Yes, perfectly said. And to that point, that's in fact that idea of failing as a mother to protect Jack. That's essentially Beverly's argument to Picard a couple of seasons ago of why she didn't tell him, which he is really pissed off. And I think this is where Patrick Stewart is. He's an old man. and I think in where we've seen him in the earlier seasons, he's much, you know, he's showing his age, let's say.
Yeah.
But I think this is the spot where he found that old Picard voice. And I think that is, you know, just, you can say everything you want about the character of Picard, but the forceful performance that Stewart was able to put into it is really what sold everything. And we lost that earlier, and we got it back this season.
That's his greatest weapon. Yeah. His greatest weapon, or I should, maybe tool's a better descriptor. His greatest tool is his voice.
Yeah.
Both in terms of just the his anatomy, how his voice delivers the lines, because he has such a a commanding voice just by itself. But it's also the metaphoric voice.
Yes,
it's the subtext, the intent, the words he selects, and both of those things together, work in tandem to become, you know, his greatest weapon, his greatest tool. For peace, that's everything, you know. Picard, you know, has wanted the best for people. He wants the best for the world, and you know, wants to uphold Starfleet's values. And he does that not through, you know, the weapons on the Enterprise. He primarily does it through his voice. Hence, why he was selected multiple times as an arbiter in the series.
Yes.
Even though he'd always, you know, say, "Well, I'm not a great, you know, not a great, you know, counselor, or not a great arbitrator." It's like, no, you are. And he found that voice again in terms of how Sir Patrick Stewart delivers the lines, but also the words and the intent of, you know, what Picard is saying.
Yep. No, this is great. By the way, we got to have you on again or more often. This has been, I'm just loving eating up this discussion. A couple of things that also happened here. I want to bring up Ro. We get Ro coming back, who we think is sort of villainous, but not. I love this. No. She's got the earring, the Bajoran earring, which has the data, which leads them to, I believe, Daystrom, which then we get to really my favorite part, which is Data. You mentioned your favorite characters, and I was thinking about this a lot. I think Data's my guy.
Data's right up there for me too. Yeah. He is like so much of we learn about being human from this android. Yes. And in this android's exploration of humanity, we learn so much about what it means to be human through him. In many ways, you could think of Data as our conduit, as an audience. He is actually our avenue into this universe, because he's learning what it means to be human, which is what we're doing as the audience. And so I agree with you. Such a such a great character, and only as can exist in Star Trek.
Yeah, he's super smart, but at the same time, childlike in many respects. I would agree. That's sort of our window into that world. For levity, of course, his friendship with Geordi. I think they pushed the friendship with Picard more than I thought existed. I always thought it was more of a Geordi thing than Picard.
Yeah, it was. I think that comes from Star Trek Nemesis. We get that that relationship between Picard and Data. But I agree. Throughout the series, the strongest friendship was always between Geordi and Data, which is leaned into a bit more heavily in the last couple of episodes.
Yeah.
But I don't think they leaned into it as much as they should, because that you're right. That is where the greater friendship was between Data and Geordi.
Yeah. Who we also, we get Moriarty, which was kind of interesting.
But for just a brief second, when I heard the announcement that Daniel B. Davis was going to hang up his feather duster from the nanny and reprise his role as Professor Moriarty, I was really excited. And then it's just like, he's kind of a defense mechanism that was on screen for like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And maybe that's all, Daniel Davis wanted to do. I mean, because perhaps he's retired. He's like, sure, I'll come back and do this, really quickly. So I'm not going to blame the writers, because maybe it was just that's all he wanted to do. But it would have been nice. I didn't need him to be our big bad, but right. I would have liked him to be on screen a bit more, because Moriarty is like, he's like one of those kind of an anti-hero that was smarter than Data, because he was engineered I forget how Geordi, or it might have been Barclay, it wouldn't have been Barclay, because we got Professor Moriarty's actually season two. So it would have been how Geordi programmed Moriarty to be able to beat Data.
Right.
And so I would have liked that to have seen that a little bit more, but just still seeing the callback Moriarty and the way they brought him in was kind of creepy. I liked it. But yeah, it was really fun seeing Moriarty again. I guess he was finished with his endless adventures that they were able to create for him on that little hard drive or whatever at the end of that one episode.
You just reminded me of how great those TNG episodes are. Especially when Data's bringing Geordi along into the holodeck and Geordi is just bored out of his mind because Data just solves it in like 10 seconds.
He does. Yes.
You don't get it, Data. Really this isn't the point. And so they end up creating this problem. Yeah. Great stuff. So we get a little bit of more, it's fine. We move on. And then we get Geordi at the museum, which is great. And all this, of course, which I don't think I mentioned, is leading up to some plot at Frontier Day, which gets slowly unveiled of what it is that's going to happen. And we get trying to bring Data back. We get the Data versus lore battle. I love this. What'd you think of that?
Oh, great scenes. Because that again, directly inspired by how Data and lore, what Data and lore's relationship was in TNG. Because they really are two sides of the same coin. Lore possesses qualities that Data admires because he it's the ability to emote.
Yeah.
And even though Lore uses it, you know, for evil, Data, you know, can't help but be intrigued by that because that is something he lacks. And so he says things that I think Data's like, I can understand how you can arrive at that conclusion, but your methods are all wrong. And so we were able to see that internal battle, and it was delivered so incredibly well, because there was a moment that I was concerned that Lore was going to take over, because it really looked like, I ultimately figured he probably wouldn't, but there was that feeling that he could have taken over, and it came real close, especially when Geordi removed that partition between the two, and it was up to Data to overcome. And I love how we get the little cameo from Spot.
Yes.
And like that was really good. Spot, a little MVP in that episode.
And yeah, Data sort of explains how important the cat was to him. You know, yes. I felt that strongly, you know, because we know he tended to this animal, and he learned so much about this little orange creature that mm-hmm. taught him so much about the world. Fascinating. And speaking of, we mentioned sort of dilemmas, philosophy. This is, they're bringing Data back to life where he was ready to be done. And so there's a real question there. And to him, he's like, no, this is okay, because now I'm finally getting what I wanted. Data is finally, call him complete, because he's got Data. He's got a little bit of Lore, just as you say, in those mm-hmm. parts that were missing, and a little bit of Dr. Soong, I believe, inside of him as well. And now he's kind of fully realized. Would you say?
Yeah, no, exactly. And he even has the ability to age, which a little wonky, but they explain it away. They explain it away well enough. I mean, that's they had to figure out, you know, something to do there. And I think for what it's worth, they did the best job they could with the whole, you know, AI organic thing. And so he, you know, is finally realized everything that he wanted. And he still feels like Data. He doesn't feel like somebody completely different. He feels like Data.
Yes, yes, exactly. And I love when he comes online and retakes the ship, and he's announcing ship wide, something like, this is your pissed off security droid or something like that. Whatever. Yeah. I was sitting, I was watching the show. It was late at night, I think, and my wife's asleep, and I'm like, I think I woke her up because I kind of just like involuntarily cheered when he said.
But she doesn't watch either?
No, she's not a Trekkie. She doesn't really.
She needs to be assimilated.
She does. Yeah. Okay, so let's round off these last two episodes, which is I almost call a mini movie, kind of. Really all about the Borg. This is where we're headed. Mm-hmm. And we find
behind
out,
the door, and yes. I wasn't sure what to expect behind the door. Like, I heard who I thought was Alice, is it Krige or Krige? Mm-hmm. I've never looked how to pronounce her last name. But it's like, that sounds like the Borg Queen's voice, but I thought between First Contact and season two, I thought we were like, you know, we were done with the Borg Queen. Yeah. And then there were theories floating around with one of the kind of like that demon like big bad from DS9, you know, perhaps, you know, they, you know, it had, you know, come back in here.
Yeah.
And it's, I didn't know, but it's like, I think that's the Borg Queen's voice, but I ended up thinking it was not going to be the Borg Queen, because it's just, well, I've seen her die twice. So that red door sequence with Deanna, let's go through the red door. And it's really scary stuff. It has some horror adjacency.
Yeah.
And that's when it's like, oh boy, like this is not good. This could spell for disaster. And I've never seen the Borg more intense and scary and almost a self-actualized for a Borg in how they were here in the last couple of episodes.
Yeah, I agree with that. And basically we get the plot that the changelings were working with the Borg to mm-hmm. using. So they're trying to get Jack's DNA because we find out he's a transmitter, or can be used as a transmitter.
Yes, because of the little pieces of Borg that were still in Picard, which makes sense because even in the Best of Both Worlds, we learn that, and I think Dr. Crusher mentions to him that there's always going to be some Borg in him.
Right.
And you know, we get that a little bit more in First Contact, and we get that here. And so it makes sense. And it's just like, who cares if I can't figure out biologically how that works? That's not the point. The point is there was always a little bit of Borg in him. And we've seen really all through Voyager what those nanoprobes can do. And so I feel, you know, it made sense to pass that on to Jack. And so he is kind of like the word when you have a virus and you don't have any symptoms, but you can pass it on.
Carrier.
Carrier. So he's like, he's a carrier of, we'll call it nanoprobes. And so he's a carrier of these Borg or Borg-like nanoprobes.
Yeah. And then they can, they're assimilating through the transporters.
Yeah.
That was kind of interesting. And it only affects people under 25. What'd you think of that?
Oh, okay. So just real quick before I get to that, I thought we were going to get a cameo by Dana Molnar as Dr. Pulaski, because if you remember from season two,
she didn't.
Yes, she doesn't use a transporter because Picard's like, oh, she doesn't use a transporter. And then the other admiral's like, no, she doesn't. And she is underrated. I really, as an adult, I really appreciate her as a ship's doctor in season two. Yeah. But I thought she was going to come back because of her knowledge about transporters and never using a transporter. So I thought we were setting up a cameo by Dr. Pulaski. But back to your point about under 25, that it's very clearly a cautionary tale for today. It's a commentary on today's youth, which are so incredibly impressionable, perhaps more impressionable than youth have been, maybe since the dawn of time, or at least, the last, a few hundred years, because it mentions what is kind of attracting them to the Borg, and what we learn attracts Jack to the Borg is this idea of a utopia, of this existence without pain, without fear. And I feel those that are under 25, they just hear, oh, no pain, no fear, peace, utopia, and they eat this up, failing to realize that even Shakespeare told us that in The Tempest, that utopia is an impossibility. And so anytime it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah.
And so I like that. It's like, because it's so easily swayed, and it's because of, these ideas, which are impossibilities or are impractical, sounds great in theory, but it doesn't work. Or if it quote works, it comes at a great cost. And that great cost is individuality. And so that is what the Borg represents, is a complete loss of individuality. Thinking is one, behaving is one, and destroying anybody that would come between you and this idea of a perfected existence. And I'm so glad they made it 25 and under, because so often in shows today, it's those that are, say, over 25 are the ones that are shown to be corrupt, or they're the ones that are responsible for a disaster. But we it's the inverse of that here, which is more reflexive of where we are in the real world today, much more reflexive of reality. And so I love that the show did that. It was no longer the sexy young people coming to save the day from the corrupt adults. It was the reverse of that.
Fantastic stuff there. What's so interesting about what you said about that sort of going to a place that removes you from pain, that draw, what the show does is it when it gets you to that point where we see Jack sort of where when Picard and Jack are both in that Borg, whatever we call that place. I don't know what.
Unimatrix.
Yes. Okay. There you go. Yeah. Thank you. And Jack's like, yes, I don't, because he's dealing with his own crap. He's always been different, as they say. He's felt different than it wasn't just that he's always kind of had these hints of these abilities, and it's always made him feel weird. And of course, he never knew his father, and he's always kind of on the run. He's a bit of a rogue, I guess, kind of maybe going around scamming people a little bit. You know, usually for a good reason, but kind of living life on the edge a little bit. What it does is it shows other characters in the show dealing with and moving on from their pain. We get, Riker moving on from his grief. You get Shaw. Shaw becomes, he learns forgiveness, to Picard, that kind of stuff. And then of course, as we talked about with Picard kind of growing a little bit further at the end of his life, finally getting some kind of a resolution. So the show does, it gives you a path of these characters to solve their issues, and that's the real life, right? It's not it's not the Borg life, running away and looking to hide your pain. I also kind of saw maybe an addiction analogy in there as well. They didn't really explore that at all, but I could see that one applying.
Yeah, we didn't explore it as heavily as we did in that. I think it's a season one of Trek, which is so clearly sponsored by Dare, because Will he's like, oh, it's that colony, which is clearly addicted to drugs, and young Crusher's like, he's like, oh, like drugs, and they're like, yes, like drugs, and it was just like so over the top. It's like, okay, I get it, this is the 1980s war on drugs, and like that one is a bit more overt than some of the others. But I always find it a little that episode particularly comical because of just how just melodramatic everything is. So we don't lead into it quite.
Well, we get Raffi. I almost forgot, because she's getting over her addiction. Yeah.
Yes, and so she has, she has her own journey, which sometimes she feels like a paper character, which is like, why is she in here? But then other times, she has, it's just like, oh, really interesting. So I don't know why it was kind of inconsistent. There was inconsistency in her very brief, relationship with Seven. There was inconsistency in her prominence in the series. There was just so much inconsistency. Now, I love how this ends, warrior of the house, whatever her last name was.
I forgot she had a relationship with Seven.
just kind of one dimensional until the end, and not very likable. I think that's part of the problem. I like what we were trying to do, getting over the trauma, getting over the addiction, to regain family, all really great things. And the actor, I really like her. I think as an actor, she was really good. I didn't particularly care for her character because seasons one and two kind of made me not like her. She was not a likable character. And that's the problem. How do I pull for somebody, root for someone to overcome if you haven't made them likable?
I have the same dilemma with
everybody. Because she hated everybody, hated Starfleet, hated Picard. She hated everyone. It's like,
why are you here?
and so I want to like her. And in my article that kind of reviewed the series, I didn't particularly care for her. And it's because until the very end, you didn't give me a lot to like, because you made her not a pleasant character.
I did like pairing her with Worf, though, at least.
That's when she came into her own. Yeah. Once she got with Worf, I did like her more.
He doesn't put up with her shit, basically.
No.
And that's what she needed. She needed a kick in the ass, basically.
Yeah, she did. And she was better for it. I can tell in her heart, she's a warrior. But she needed that swift kick in the ass in order to come around, and nobody wanted to really challenge her.
Right.
And so we finally get that. So I do wish her character had been handled, you know, more, which her character had been crafted with more intention. It almost feels like an afterthought, which is a disservice to the actor and to the character.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And so we basically close with the Titan being renamed the Enterprise G. We got Jack goes with Seven, and they have kind of a new crew.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, this is what I think maybe people are hoping what Star Trek Legacy could be. I thought this was a great end for mm-hmm. everybody involved. I really couldn't think of a better way to send off these TNG characters than what
great
they did
farewell. Because in the original series, although I liked that poker game at the end, it never felt like there was enough closure, because the series finale just kind of comes out of nowhere, because they were originally contracted for an eighth season, but they decided to scrap the eighth season in order to do Star Trek Generations, which I recently rewatched. It's not as bad as I remember. Generations isn't great, but right. It's also not as bad as I remember. And it does factor into Picard, because which we totally skipped over, the you know, Geordi rebuilding the Enterprise.
Oh yeah, and, God, how can we forget that?
And there's a callback to Generations, because it is it crash lands, the star drive is destroyed in a warp core breach, and then the saucer section crash lands on Viridian 3.
Yep,
and
you can see the scorch marks on the outside of it, by the way.
Yes, yeah, you can. Yeah. And so he's been working on restoring it. Great way to bring the Enterprise D back, and for the most part. Makes sense. Geordi retired totally strikes me as somebody who would be doing that.
Totally, yeah.
So I very much buy how the Enterprise returns, and seeing everybody on the bridge of the Enterprise, I cried when they boarded the Enterprise, and like I had tears in my eyes. I'm like, yes. they're back. You know, the Starfleet ship. You know, the flagship of all time is back. And I just love that moment. They walk on, we see her, and then they walk onto the bridge. I had tears in my eyes. And I love that it became a character. Because you know what? The starships in Star Trek, especially, I would say, the Enterprise D and Voyager, are characters.
Yes.
Oh, and yeah. So that was missing. And so we brought back a character. Enterprise D is a character. So no return to Trek is complete without all of your characters, of which the Enterprise is one.
Yeah.
And so them all being back, you know, tears in my eyes. and we finally, I didn't need it to continue, because it is an older ship. Totally get it. But I love how throughout the series, they were always the cavalry, and the Enterprise D comes back and takes care of them one last time and is the cavalry. And it's also a commentary on age. We do have this running commentary on age all through season 3. As like, don't discount somebody simply because they're older. They still have a lot to give. And that is the Enterprise. And because it was older, it wasn't caught up and all the AI mess that the Borg were able to manipulate, you know, to assimilate in the here in the showdown. So I like we have that commentary on aging and how, you know, don't discount, you know, somebody or something simply because it's older. It may still have a lot to offer. And when we're back on the bridge of the now Enterprise G, which, it's like, I kind of feel like we take a step backwards, because I think it's like a modified Constitution class, which is not nearly as impressive as the Galaxy class, but whatever.
I would have been fine just keeping it called the Titan. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, that I would have been, because it's like, it doesn't, I mean, I guess it looks like old school Enterprise, but it's just like you're taking the ship backwards, or if it had been like, in the style of the Enterprise, is the DE, they've been in the style of the F, which we do see briefly, because that's the one Commander Shelby is on. Mm-hmm. And so but you know, we get that they're on the bridge, and I like how that kind of does feel like a little family. I could see them all working together as a family, And I think Jack as a Deanna like character, as a special counsel, I think does work because of all of his missions with his mom has a lot of qualities that I think a counselor like, albeit not an empath, but a counselor like individual would be able to bring to a captain. And so I like how Seven has him as her special counsel. And then that poker game, they're back at 10 forward. Why isn't Whoopi Goldberg here? Like,
I don't know. Yeah,
she's giving us the evil eye. And it's just like, was she maybe just not available? Or it's just kind of odd. Or just don't say anything. It just felt really weird.
Yeah,
that
they mentioned
like,
her. Yeah.
And she's not there.
I don't understand. I didn't understand what that line was.
I think it was maybe the intention was to get her, but then they weren't able to. I don't know, but it was like just I would have cut that line out because yes. we don't see her, yeah. But we get that poker game and how they're playing the poker game is a reflection of the poker game at the end of the All Good Things at the end of All Good Things, but. That's not actually the end now, is it, of the Picard series finale? And this part put the biggest smile on my face because I almost didn't watch for a mid-credit scene. And so I'm so glad I did because it's like, whoa, I'm pretty sure you just added that after you saw how successful this was. And I'm so glad you did. Because what do we get, Ben?
We get Q.
Yes, John DeLancey back as Q. I was like, oh my gosh, I have the biggest smile on my face. I love Q. One of my favorite recurring guest characters in Star Trek. On the Besada Geek Pod, I'm on all the Q episodes because I love Q's character because he challenges Picard in ways that nobody else can.
Yeah.
And ultimately, he has their best interest at heart, even though he's got some perhaps unethical ways of going about it. But he ultimately does have their best interest at heart and never means anything he does maliciously.
Now, and of course, well played by John DeLancey. It's just good to see him back. How is he going to die? So I think it made perfect sense that he came back. It's like, oh, you're thinking so linearly.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it works so well. And it gives me hope because we have in a show like Legacies, because we have Q, legacy character, Seven of Nine, legacy character. And, maybe one day Rafi and Jack will be legacy characters too. But, I think a spinoff series that Q pops in and out of works really well because the episodes of Voyager where Q pops in and out, I love them because it's a direct connection to TNG. And then DS9, there's a Q episode on DS9. Because also on DS9, we get Picard's love interest Vosh from those couple of episodes in TNG. Yeah. We actually do get the one and of course, the late Gene Roddenberry's wife, the late Mijel Barrett, she also makes an appearance in DS9. And we can't talk about Star Trek Picard without acknowledging, the brilliance that was Gene Roddenberry's vision, which was fully realized in Next Generation. Respect TOS. And I love that we've got a connection to Lucille Ball because it was Desilu Productions, which worked with Gene Roddenberry to launch it. But Next Generation, that's what he wanted. We'd be remiss not to mention the return of Mijel Barrett's voice as the ship's computer.
Oh, yes.
And even Riker, when they leave the bridge for the last time, it's like, I miss that voice. You know what? We miss that voice too.
Yeah.
I love hearing her voice come back on the Enterprise.
And the chirp,
computer. And the chirp. Yes.
Yeah, I
need to get a doorbell that chirps like that. I want to program my Alexa or Siri to respond to computer.
Oh, that'd
and,
be great.
My friend Greg last night when I was with when I was with he and his wife, my best friend, he mentioned that his brother, who's also a big Trekkie, actually, mm-hmm. he watches an episode of Voyager, DS9, and TNG every single day.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, but he programmed either his Alexa or his Siri to respond to computer.
Oh, you got to get
that. And so, like, I need to find out how that works, because I would talk to Alexa and Siri way more often if I could refer to them as computer, because I would totally eat that up. But hearing our voice, I loved it. It was such a, like, they didn't have to do that. And I imagine it was very difficult to do, because that was a lot of hunting through TNG to find all the exact words they needed for those few lines. But yeah. it was such a nice touch.
Yeah, I agree. And I think my sort of final thoughts are this season, to me, was really, and to your point, adding the voice, I think it speaks to the fact of how this series, or this season rather, was crafted with love. And for the fans, and mm-hmm. by people who know Trek, for people who don't have to know Trek, but can, if they already don't, they could learn what Trek is all about. And I think it was just, not perfect, but brilliant for what it tried to do. And just, there's so much love in this season. And yeah, I'm so happy that, hey, this is all, at least I got something out of, new Trek, if we want to call it that. They have this season, this legacy series, whatever they set up, it's there for you, Paramount. Just go take it. And then, it's there. Go for it. This shows you a path. It is, not only is it, sure, it appeals more to the older fans, but mm-hmm. it's popular and people watch it. So even if it's not the new audience you're trying to create, whatever, because people like it. And then, as you said, this formula works. You will grow an audience if they follow this formula.
This character mix, this plot, these plots are at perfection, as Seven would put it. You know, the characters and plots, they explore humanity in ways that can be difficult otherwise, and they do it through this allegory, and it's that exploration of the human condition which is the greatest exploration. And Trek needs its captain, whether we're talking Picard, Sisko, Janeway, Pike, Kurt, Shaw. We need a captain, and we need that captain to be a strong leader, upholding the best expression of morals and ethics and the order of Starfleet. And it doesn't mean those values and beliefs can't be challenged. We certainly saw throughout TNG Picard challenging Starfleet, and one of the episodes that jumps to mind is when they're deciding whether or not Data is alive. You know, Picard challenges Starfleet. A Measure of a Man, I think, is the name of that episode. And so he challenges it. It's the pursuit of the best humanity can be to one another that is the most meaningful, and what keeps Q curious about humanity, in particularly Picard. It's that strong moral center. So Picard season 3 embraces this return to form. It embraces the Star Trek formula, especially here at the end. And, you know, I've seen articles out there that are accusing Star Trek Picard of a disappointing third season. I mean, I can't believe it, because they're like, it's looking backwards when it should be looking forwards. Oh, and it's just like, no, it is Star Trek's, because the Star Trek series, you know, it needs starships, it needs uniforms, it needs those military-like rules and that ethical center. And that doesn't mean it's looking backwards. Those are the tent poles that significantly impact the form the show takes and the viewer experience. You mm-hmm. remove those tent poles and the show collapses. And Picard takes us back to what makes Trek great. And I hope it continues on this path.
Ryan, thank you so much for coming on today. This was, I just love this conversation. We got to have you on again in the future, not wait 2 or 3 years to have you back. And
no, I hope to see you at screenings. I haven't seen you at any of the screenings over the last, several weeks or a few months.
Yeah, I've been, it's just been hard for me to, I don't know. I need to get there. Well, I also, The other thing too is I like to go with my wife, so sometimes I'll wait a couple of days and just go to see it with her because something she wants to see, and she's not always available to come with me on a Wednesday at 7:30, you know, out in Tampa or something. That's really for the hardcore folks. So if it's something that she wants, I've been bringing her along a lot, and I re-up my I've been slacking. Thanks, Ryan, for calling me out on that. But yeah, I love can't wait to see you again at a future screening, and really just. Thank you so much for coming on. Give a quick rundown for everybody where they can find you.
Sure. You can hang out with me on Twitter at RLTerry1. You can follow me on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/RLTerry or my blog at RLTerryRealView.com.
Ryan, thank you so much for coming on again. Thank you all for listening. We'll catch you all in the next episode.